Over the past few years, our attention at these Remembrance Day services has been on the Great War. This morning we turn our attention to the Second World War, and in particular to one of its most significant conflicts, the Battle of Britain, in which one of our parishioners, Pilot Officer Hodgson, took part. He's commemorated in the window over there. He actually did take part in the Battle of Britain, was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. He died accidentally. He was coming home on leave in a transport plane which crashed outside Saffron Walden in 1943. I was astonished in talking to a St Barnabas resident recently that she knew both the Hodgson boys in their growing up years, as indeed apparently did Dawn Bockup. As we reflect on the Battle of Britain, I want first of all to reflect on the providence of God. On Friday the 24th of May 1940, General Heinz Guderian's 1st Panzer Division reached the Arles canalised river south of Gravelines in France, and in fierce fighting secured bridgeheads across it. They were only 10 miles away from 400,000 exhausted Allied soldiers pinned down on the Flanders beaches. Then, just as one of the greatest tank commanders of World War II prepared his highly effective mechanised unit for one of the greatest military coups of the 20th century, he received an order to halt. Despite his protestations, 3 days later, the order was still in force. In the meantime, the perimeter was fortified, and over the next 9 days, 338,000 Allied troops were evacuated to Britain in Operation Dynamo. Guderian always believed that Hitler's order was one of the greatest mistakes of World War II, for, in his words, only the capture of the British Expeditionary Force could have created the conditions necessary for a successful German invasion of Great Britain. Hitler's order to halt was inexplicable and fateful in its consequences. Equally hard to understand is his total lack of interest in launching the invasion in June, when the home counties were wide open to invasion by the Wehrmacht. Indeed, the longer the discerning eye rests on the events of 1940, the more puzzling questions and odd coincidences pile up. Take, for instance, the evacuation at Dunkirk, where 250,000 Allied troops walked to safety down a 1,400-yard-long, 5-foot-wide wooden pier at the East Mole. For over a week, the Stukas bombed it and failed to hit it even once. Then came the failure to run with plans of imagination and daring. What if the plan of General Erhard Milch of the Luftwaffe to drop 5,000 parachutists on the 7 vital RAF sectors in southeast England with a mission to rip out the heart of fighter command had been adopted rather than rejected by Goering? What if General Kurt Student had been in a position to drop his parachute division on just one Allied airfield and turn it into an air bridge for the bulk of the invasion forces? It worked in Crete, why not in southern England? Equally puzzling were the errors of judgment made during the Battle of Britain. It was a good opening move to start bombing the radar stations along the English coastline, but just as this was beginning to bear fruit, the bombing effort was switched to the fighter airfields in the south. Then, just as the Luftwaffe began to overpower fighter command, the decision was made to leave the airfields alone and to concentrate instead on the terror bombing of London. A military commentator once said that war is a catalogue of mistakes and that victory goes to the side that makes the fewest mistakes. But in this case, you have to wonder at so many extraordinary decisions, so many errors of judgment, so much bad timing, so many opportunities missed. It's always presumptuous to try reading the mind of God and the events of history. Yet here is a combination of events where you might be tempted to think that something more than met the eye was going on here. If you believe that we do not live in a world where things just happen, then you might want to give thanks to God that in the late summer of 1940, one of the most evil enterprises humankind has ever known received its first significant setback. So this morning we're giving thanks to God. In doing so, we're also given an opportunity to reflect on a minor miracle that occurred at that time. People who lived in Britain in the years 1940-41 always comment on the remarkable feeling of collective solidarity that bound together the inhabitants of those islands. People were kind to each other and looked out for each other more than usual. Suicide rates and reported cases of mental health difficulties significantly decreased. People felt infused with a sense of hope and meaning in life despite the grimness of everything. They were caught up in a collective enterprise that profoundly mattered. This was what sociologists call an experience of communitatis. We might want to reflect today on why it takes the prospect of military defeat to shock a nation into a way of living where self-sacrifice, generosity of spirit, moral heroism, and sharing became the norm. Without a doubt, it was their finest hour, but as soon as the crisis passed, people went back to their normal moral torpor. Since the war, many English people have felt that their society is slowly falling apart. There has been a feeling common in many Western democracies that their political leadership has lost its way and can only appeal to their citizens' desire for material prosperity. Think of the political language that's used often at election times. Often it's our greed and our fears that are appended to. Really, do we hear appeals for self-sacrifice, or is our support enlisted for crusades against human misery? For a brief moment, in the early 1940s, things were different. But it took a terrible common danger to get society into that place. So today we might want to ask, how shall we set about recovering that political language of collective moral endeavour? And there is a follow-on question that's troubling for the human spirit. I've never forgotten a question put to us in a sermon at morning prayer when I was staying at Virginia Theological Seminary in 1990, just before the start of the Gulf War. Why does it take a war to make us feel intensely alive? Finally, I want to consider some of the troubling knock-on consequences of the Battle of Britain. A few years ago, I visited a retired farmer in Ashburton, the father, in fact, of an Anglican priest in the diocese. It turned out that he had been in bomber command during the war. I asked him a few questions about that time in his life and discovered, to my astonishment, that I was talking to someone who had taken part in the firebombing of Dresden in 1945. He got out the maps that showed the approach route they'd taken for the run into the target. He showed me the Lancaster logs, which stated in unemotional notes the hours flown on the mission and the precise mix of high explosive and incendiaries dropped. What struck me at the time was the completely untroubled way this man described taking part in an attack on a target of no military significance against a beaten enemy, in which in a space of 24 hours, tens of thousands of civilians were asphyxiated or incinerated. When the Luftwaffe bombed London and then went on later to bomb provincial cities like Coventry and Bristol, a desire for revenge was engendered. The rapid expansion of Bomber Command was seen as a way to strike back at a foe who was too powerful to be confronted on land in Western Europe. So began a cycle of saturation bombing attacks on industrial German cities, in which artificial firestorms were created to cause immense loss of life, with the deliberate intention of terrorising the civilian population. This was total war indeed. In doing this, Britain and the Western Allies lost the moral high ground they had gained during the Battle of Britain. They began to run the risk, which always occurs in war, of becoming a mirror image of the enemy they opposed, or suffering a serious moral defeat by their own actions. So it was that we came to live in a world where the wiping out of civilian populations came to be seen as a normal part of warfare. Our moral sensibilities have been accordingly desensitized. Canon John Collins, one of the founding fathers of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, was radicalized into this later ministry through his experience of being a chaplain to the headquarters of Bomber Command. His talk to aircrew entitled, "God is my co-pilot," so upset the top brass that they brought in a high-powered lecturer to give a talk called The Ethics of Bombing. During question time, John Collins got up at the back of the hall to offer the opinion that the talk should more aptly have been entitled The Bombing of Ethics. Nor did the troubling ethical questions lie only in the ashes of Hamburg and Dresden. It has now become clear the quality and quantity of the ultra intercepts meant that the Western Allies were aware by 1941 that a mass extermination campaign was underway against European Jewry. The top political and military leadership knew where the death camps were, what they were doing, and approximately how many people they were doing it to. Why then was Bomber Command not used to bomb the railway lines and marshalling yards which were used to transport the victims of the Holocaust to the death camps? Why were the barracks and compounds of the Einsatzgruppen not subjected to regular precision bombing attacks? The Mosquito Pathfinder squadrons and the Dambuster squadron had the skills and the technical means for such missions. I'm clear that whatever could have been done should have been done to try and save as many Jewish lives as possible. These precision bombing attacks could also have been directed against the Gestapo and the detention centres and torture centres, as they occasionally were, with considerable effectiveness. So today I'm left with two conflicting sets of feelings: gratitude for the sacrifice made by the pilots of Fighter Command who died in the skies over southern England in 1940. Gratitude is what I feel in equal measure for the sacrifice made by the 50,000 aircrew who died in the bomber offensive against Germany, the highest proportionate losses of any service in the Allied armed forces. These young men died mostly in circumstances of terror and great pain. This morning we acknowledge them and honour them and pray for them. Also, I feel regret that their endeavours were not channeled into operations of higher moral purpose and greater military effectiveness. The misery visited on the civilian population of Germany did little to shorten the war. And that is something that is worth saying too, that our sympathy and prayers for the slaughtered civilian populations of London, Coventry, Hamburg, Dresden are surely an important part of today's remembrance. It would have been better, I believe, if the military assets of Bomber Command had been used instead to bring about an earlier and decisive end to the Battle of the Atlantic, upon which the Allied war effort totally depended, and to turn the skies over the death camps of Festung Europa into a dangerous and menacing reality for the executioners of the children of Israel.